Session number 15433.
Peter McAleese, side 15. Managerial positions, suburbs of Pretoria, Kalavuskin, yeah. You're saying?
Yeah, you know, under the apartheid system, the whites were always in charge, and you know, there was a full employment as well, because, you'd, like, take the police force, you had different types of police. You had professional policemen who wore blue uniforms, then you had the traffic policemen who wore brown ones. Now, the actual calibre of man you were dealing with was totally different. One was a professional policeman, the other was a megalomaniac trying to collect fines, you know. And the thing with the traffic policeman, and what I will say, what was fair about the system there was, if you had a traffic offence against you, you could actually go into the office and state your case in the office without doing it in court, and a decision would be made at the office on the as to the outcome, you know. There was that, but they had this obsession about speeding, you know. When I got there at first, the speed limit was 57 miles an hour, you know, and not 1 mile an hour more, you know. It was totally unacceptable. And if you're up to, say, 20 miles over the limit, they sort of could impound your car, pardon me. I parked my car in the wrong, an army truck on the wrong side of the street one day, and this traffic policeman came in, and he had a black leather coat on with his uniform, and he said, "You're parked on the wrong side of the street." And I said, "But so are you, because his car was behind mine." And he says, "Move your car." And I says, "Well, I'll move mine at the same time as you." And I suddenly realised that the guy wasn't switched on as he should have been, and I started winding him up. And I says, "You know, the last time I seen a coat like that was in a movie, and the chap was wearing black wire glasses, asking someone for his papers." And went, "You what?" So, you know, and I just went, laughed at him, and I walked out. And lucky enough, the number plates of my vehicle were dirty. I'd been on an exercise, and he couldn't get the number correct. So, you know, when the actual complaint came through, yeah, to the army authorities, there was sort of two digits missing off, right, it.
So they were various jobs they,
yeah,
had there.
And the other chaps who used to check on the Dom Pass, they wore grey uniforms. And I seen one case, there was an African had wandered away from his truck, and he was about 100 metres away, and his boss came, and he said, They've taken my driver. The guy was trying to explain that his pass was in the truck. And these guys, I mean, they were enthusiastic. I mean, they had these big, long, sort of, their equivalent of the Black Mariah. And they could get maybe between 50 and 60. You know?
It was a caged in truck.
Yeah, caged in truck, yeah, with wire on it. You know?
Yeah, caged in full ton truck. Yeah.
You know, the poor old African sitting there, and he's trying to explain his passes in the car. I mean, some of those guys, there was no leeway given by them. You know, it's just the way they were.
Mm. I was going to ask you, what was their attitude to the Africans and their servants? Had they all got servants, had they?
No. A lot of when you talked about poor whites in South Africa, you were talking about poor whites. Mm. And they managed their own affairs. But most of these sort of, as you say, a middle class, and you've got to understand that was the majority of the people had the majority of the white people,
yeah,
had servants. Yeah.
Well, Abraham, did you have a servant or?
Yes, I did.
You did, right?
But the Jane.
That was her name, or?
Oh, Mildred. It was
Mildred.
Aye.
How did she?
In actual fact, Jane used to get intimidated by her, because Jane wasn't used to it all, and you know, she'd come and sort of clean the house up while Jane was at work. And she was a lovely woman. She said, in actual fact, I took her home to a township one night, and she had a beautiful house in the township. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And she was a very proud woman, you know. Whereas in Rhodesia, a chap came up to me one day, and I can remember the incident well. A chap called Crispin, and he came to my door, and he's boss. You know, says, "Can you give me some work?" And he was sort of, you know, run down and whatnot. I said, "Okay." I says, "You can do my garden." So there was a little kaya, what they called a kaya. Every Rhodesian house had one, which was for the African servants. So I took them and I put them in there. So I went to this store and I lifted up two packets.
A glorified hut, brick hut.
Yes, yeah. It's a brick hut with a little fireplace, yeah, and, you know, stuff where they could dry his clothes. And I went down to store and I lifted two packets of mealy meal, which the African eats, you know, it's maize. And I went to walk away and the next thing was, where are you going with that? I said, where am I going with what? You haven't got your coupons. I says, what coupons? I didn't know anything about this. She says, you're supposed to have coupons. And I says, well, I said,
where's this in a shop?
In a shop, yeah. I says, you got, I says, well, where did I get them from? She says, the district commissioner.
This is in Rhodesia.
In Rhodesia, yeah. I'm talking about the two societies. Uh-huh. And I then went to the down to the district commissioner. I says, listen, I've got an African guy there. You know, he's got no work. I don't have his dom pass yet. You know, and I said, I don't have time to fill in forms and whatnot. I says, the guy is hungry. Can he organise me to get some mealy meal? He says, you have two large Doberman dogs, don't you? I says, no, I don't. He says, yes, you have. You have two large Doberman dogs. I says, okay, right, I've got two large Doberman dogs. He says, right, there's the book. And I get two packets of mealy meal for, you know, feeding my fictitious dogs. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I said, I'm not doing this. So I went to, there was a Salu scout fort there who had a lot of black troops. And I spoke to one of the Q men. I said, listen, I've got this African guy. He says, no problem. He gave me a 55 kg bag of mealy meal and what they call ration meat. Anything other than the rump, the sirloin, and the fillet is just cut into squares in Rhodesia for the African.
Really?
Yeah. So he gave me a 55 kg bag of this, and so I drove the Land Rover into the house. I says, Crispin, I've got something for you. I gave him this bag of mealy meal and a bag of meat, and he took off into this kaya, and it was, you know, there was sort of a burning smell coming from the chimney, you know, like, and he emerged 3 days later out of this place about 10 pounds heavier, you know. You know, they had a funny side to it, you know, and, you know, they had to keep the movement of the mealy meal down because people were giving it to the terrorists, you know.
Yeah, I see.
Aye.
I see.
And that was
but
the reason for
these dome pass, I haven't heard of that. Now, was that, let me just get this right, was that in Rhodesia?
And South Africa.
And South Africa.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The grey ones, that you, ones in the grey uniforms, that I can't recall.
No, they didn't exist in Rhodesia, the ones with the grey uniforms. And in Rhodesia,
I can't actually, it was just maybe the police. I can recall them, I can't tell you.
No, you never seen, they used to come out at night, they were always prowling about.
Right.
You know, did this, you know, thing about cleansing the society, you know, the, I mean, you said you were in Bloemfontein. I mean, can't you recall the siren going off at 10 o'clock at night?
I only stayed.
Yeah.
Yes, I can.
Yeah, well, the siren used to go to tell the Africans to get out of town.
Yeah, but I only stayed overnight twice in Bloemfontein. But I think that I can recall seeing those guys, perhaps to do with the southwest to Soweto administration, I guess. But I was in lived in Randburg and
one of the privileged.
But we didn't. I never saw them round there, and I stayed over a year there or something. Yeah. I mean, but nevertheless, how did they treat their servants? These guys,
the thing about let me firstly go on about Rhodesia. In Rhodesia, the actual white Rhodesian had an obligation towards the servants, and the majority of them looked after the schooling, the clothing of the children, the medical bills. And in actual fact, the Rhodesians had a good scene going with the African servants. The only thing is they used to think they were deaf. I mean, they'd be talking, saying, I would like a Malawian servant. See, the end thing was to have a Malawian, you know, and you know, I mean, they were never discussed as people. They were sort of an object, a thing, and they couldn't see it. And when you said anything about it, say, you'll learn, one day you'll learn, we were the same as you, and you'll learn how to treat these people. And, I mean, they were well-intentioned people because, in general, the African was looked after by the average Rhodesian family. And I've got to be fair there.
So the South Africans.
And South African, Africa, in Rhodesia, your servants were on the properties. In South Africa, they were always rushing. You've seen the South African, he was always rushing to get to work. He was always rushing to get the train. And they were shipped out of these townships. I mean, the pressure on these people was phenomenal. Mm. And, you know, I think that was the sick side of apartheid. You know, people would be working in the towns. A married man would come to the city to get work, say in security. He was away from his wife. He's living in the township. He gets paid. He's not sleeping with his wife. He goes with a prostitute. And then they start picking up social diseases. And this is, you know, there was a bad side to apartheid. You know, you know, if you spoke to an Afrikaner, he could probably justify why it was like this. But, you know, I saw another side to it.
So, in just getting back to, I mean, in South Africa, I mean, they just treated them austerely, did they, strictly?
They were the average person was fairly firm with them, you know. But, you know, you always got them around the shops and whatnot, and always around the bus stations. There were always, you know, pirate taxis, everything, you know what I mean? It was just, and in South Africa, what you've got to understand, you had an industrialised society. People were working in car firms and whatnot. You had unions. So
you
know,
which you don't have elsewhere in Africa, really.
No, you don't. Yeah. And, I mean, the unions, they were fairly militant. I mean, we had a strike at the company one day, and I said to the guy, why are you striking? He said, I don't know. I said, well, if you don't know why you're striking, he said, I've been told. You see, that is the power the unions had over.
So let's go on. Can we go on to the coin, this thing? So this company had been formed up.
Yes.
And its role was to guard key points.
Yes.
And so key points would be what? Power stations?
We did Johannesburg Power Station. We did, I think, one of the oil companies, maybe Shell. We did Caltex in Durban. We did Johannesburg Gas Works.
Had the company actually got the concession, the monopoly on it?
No. It was fairly tightly controlled, because people would come, review your, look at your training setup, you know, see if everything, the men were being trained properly, see if you had a syllabus to train them properly, and there was system to it, and very much into the leadership. And what they found out with the African is, you know, you had to sort of pull them out and retrain them every 3 months. Oh. Yeah, I mean, they were doing, the hours they were working were horrendous, you know. And, you know,
like what?
Well, you were only supposed to do an 8-hour shift.
Eight.
You know, if somebody didn't turn in, the guy would finish up doing a 16. Can you see that? And, you know, Africans, when you paid them, I mean, they some of them wouldn't bother to come into work. Mm. And the big
thing, come back after some days.
Oh, they
maybe, never see them.
No, they go drinking for 2 or 3 days and then come back and whatnot. Mm.
So could you just describe how many, that's what the firm did, and it did it all over South Africa.
Yeah.
Were there other firms doing the same thing?
Yeah, there were, the big companies were AJ Gray, Coin Security, Fidelity Garns. I mean, that was the biggest one. It was run by the Rennies Group. I mean, they were sort of nationwide, and the thing is they had an awful lot of backing from this end as well. Can you see that?
It was
international.
There is a, who is it here? This
Shield. You've got Shield here as well. I think that's.
Yeah.
I think.
But there is one of the big companies.
Group Four, is it?
Maybe it's something to do
Securitas.
With
Securitas was
group,
definitely.
Group Four. But I think they are part of Jardine Matheson. So they were doing this security guarding. So how many? What was your actual job in coin?
I started off as an operations manager, and then I worked my way through the ranks there. So,
what did you wind up as being?
I finished up as a general manager.
Really?
Sorry, area manager.
Area manager for
APWV.
For the whole of Pretoria.
Pretoria,
Witwatersrand,
and
Vereeniging. Sure, a very large area. So that covers, all over Pretoria, all of the Johannesburg area, the reef.
Yeah.
And Witwatersrand, and right down to Vereeniging, I guess. Right. So how many people were you in charge of, or how did it work?
You know, at that stage we were, at that time we had about 300 in general, about 500 guards at that time.
Now these guards, they were armed, were they? Or?
No, on the key points they were armed, the average guard wasn't.
Oh, right. So when they're at the key points, they're more or less under a military system.
Yes, they were. There was, you know, normally a white ex-junior NCO from the army in charge of them. Mm. And they only did 8-hour shifts, whereas the other guys done 12-hour shifts.
And what were they armed with, the Africans?
They were armed with shotguns and sometimes Ruger 223s, but mainly shotguns.
Right.
And they also had Star pistols.
Star pistols, yeah. And they were 9mm Star pistols, and the were they pump shotguns? Or
pump action pumps.
And out of interest, I mean, what were their rules of engagement? I mean, first ask questions later?
No. In actual fact, they were fairly strict. You know, they had to go through the whole halting procedure, the whole lot. But the great thing was that they were working inside fenced areas.
Yes.
And as I say, during the day they'd be on access control and at night patrolling. So, you know, the staff who were working at night time were normally inside the premises. So there was a couple of times when there was break-ins, you know, people trying to come over the fence and they were fired upon.
Did they actually have loaded weapons or...?
Yes.
Not a separate magazine?
No.
Was that too...
What we used to do is two things. They'd have, in the pump action, they'd have to pump it to get the round up.
Loaded but not caught.
Yeah, and on a magazine, if it was a rifle, there'd be a grenade pin through it to hold the right round down. So, you know, before you actually cocked it, you had to go through the motion of pulling the pin out and then cocking the weapon. Can you see that?
Yeah.
So it was a deliberate thing. So, you know, one couldn't get up the chamber.
Yes.
So, you know, it was before the guy
very
actually...
Very good. It's very safe system, actually.
Yeah.
And you didn't have negligent discharges.
Oh, you had quite a few, yeah.
But even with the safety pin through?
Even with the safety pin. Guys just, they couldn't help it. You know, they'd been to the school, they'd done firing... They'd done a bit, and then, you know, after months, he'd sit there playing about with a shot, and boof, you know.
Okay. So, yeah, rules of engagement. Occasionally, they did shoot at people.
Yeah.
Presumably, that was to free up troops or whoever so they could be on the border or whatever it was.
What happened is they were trying to create problems in the townships to tie down military troops in the towns. Tie down military troops guarding national key points, which meant the troops couldn't be free to go to the border.
Right.
So this was the government's answer to it.
Right. Did you actually have liaison with the local? I mean, was there an actual a local policeman or a local army officer saying you will do it this way?
Right. No, you had what was called the key points committee.
Right.
And there was a brigadier in charge of it.
Right.
And he'd come round with his little team, and you could ask him, you know, what's the latest and. You know, is there anything new come out in training systems, and what are you looking for? Anything new in the curriculum? You know,
What did what was the threat actually to key points?
The threat to key points was Sassel get blown up for starters, and then they said, right, you know, we've got to start protecting stuff, and I mean, after Sassel, they started taking it seriously. Whereas beforehand, they didn't.
Yeah. They were used limpet mines. So
yeah, that was a big thing there. I mean,
which don't require any construction.
No, they don't. I mean, all you do is stick your thing onto something, pull a pin, it eats its way through. Like it's very, very much the same as a time pencil. You screw a screw, and what happens is it breaks the acid, which eats through a lead spring, which then breaks, firing pin into a 2-2 cap, into a detonator, igniting the explosion, the explosive.
Right.
And
were they actually hitting stuff that was the actual vulnerable point in the if you see what I mean, in the key point, or was it just placing these explosives in?
No. They'd done a good job, but that, I mean, it was extremely well planned. I mean, the great thing about the limpet is you can clip it onto the bottom of a car, cover it in dust, cover it in oil. And you know, a person can see a mirror under it, but you know, unless he's actually suspicious. And some of the limpets were actually coming from other countries and actually being put onto the transport and transported in underneath railway trucks, being picked up at their destination in South Africa.
Right.
Can you see that? And they didn't know which trucks they were on.
Mm. And they were made, so were they actually Soviet manufacturer?
Soviet Chinese. Right. But I mean, they used them, and then they got the mini limpets, which they were just clipping all over the place, you know.
Brilliant.
And, you know, they go into the town, just clip one on the side of a, you know, one of these waste paper baskets.
Right.
You know, and the next thing you get bits of shrapnel being thrown all over the place.
Right. How often did you have many attacks there, actually, or did you thwart any proper attacks?
No, we didn't. No.
Right. You had your accident down there, you said.
Yeah.
What happened there, then?
I'll tell you what happened. The company I was working for was, you know, paramilitary. They know they had different groups had different colours of berries and they loved a bit of pomp and ceremony with it, you know.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
So they decided that I was going to parachute into an arena.
Where was this?
This was in out at a place called Gajima, at Hammondskraal.
Oh, right.
Very near where I used to be employed at 44. And I was going to jump in with the company flag on my ankle. So I... I hadn't jumped for about 9 months, and I was still on the Army Reserve. So on the Wednesday, I did a practice jump the Wednesday, and I was doing another one the Saturday, and then jumped with the flag on the Sunday. So I did the one the Wednesday, and everything went well. It was a military jump. The one on the Saturday, the jump was on the Monday. I was going to do one on Saturday, one on Sunday. The jump on the Saturday, I went out and it was cancelled, and I went there on the Sunday. And it was just, when I think back in it now, nothing went right. I got there and they just said, you're jumping now, there's a place for you now. I put a parachute on my back. As I ran out to the aircraft, the parachute popped. So they repacked it on my back, you know, put it back in. And then went up to 10,000 feet. We were in a Helio Porter, one of those stall aircraft, you know, short takeoff and landing. Yeah. Got up to 10,000 feet and I was on base. You know, we were doing a star. And as I went out the door...
Star formation.
Yeah,
thankful,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And I went out, my goggles blew up. And I had an altimeter in my chest which slipped down. So I said, what I'll do is I'll pull on the other guy's altimeter. So I was linked on, and at first I could see his altimeter okay.
Without goggles, yeah.
Without goggles, and then my eye really started to water.
Yeah.
But I could still see. And then I says, no, this has gone on too long. And next thing I seen, that, you know, the star was building up the whole time. I says, I'll pull on them. And as I say, I seen them pulling, breaking and pulling. And just as I went to pull, there was a guy just above me. I says, I better hang on a few more feet and in case I hit him with my bag. So I dropped and I came into the pulling position and I seen my altimeter come up. And I says, 1,200 feet. And you know, the chute popped and I could just hear the rigging lines breaking.
So what was happening now?
The rigging line. One, number one, I was too low because I should have broke up high and just pulled.
Yes.
And actually, in fact, I rode it down and these guys were hot doggers. You know, they were, you know, fun parachutists. And so I pulled and then I could hear the rigging lines breaking.
So there's a fault on the parachute.
Yeah. Okay. So the next thing was the chute went over to the side and spun me around it. It was a ram air chute.
Yeah.
And then when I was jumping with what you call a three-ring circus, so you got to go underneath the chute to discard it and then activate your reserve. Can you see that? By the time I got underneath the chute, it was at 600 feet. And I said, I'm not going to make it if I pull away. So I rode the parachute in, and it was the most exciting jump of my life, you know.
Right.
And I, believe it or not, I was fairly calm.
You know, you're going down at a real rate of knots.
Yeah, and you know, the canopy was making a sort of noise like a motorbike, you know.
Okay, you couldn't pull the reserve.
In actual fact, I did the right thing. You know, I rode it in.
Without putting a reserve.
I couldn't. You can't put your reserve up with two squares.
You've got to dump one. No.
Okay. So I rode it in. And just before I got to the ground, I said, God help me. You know, the old Christian came out of me. And the next thing is this leg just split in half. And you know,
how do you mean by that?
Everything came broke away and there was a compound fracture.
All right. Bone
was jutting out. And then I felt this one go. And then I felt my back go. And I just lay there. And the blood was sort of spurting out my leg all over me. You know, it was all over the parachute. And I think the thing I remember most about it was the comfort that my wife gave me. And the other thing I remember was my son seeing me. I was getting into a state of shock. And
so this was right in front of your family, or?
Yes, yeah.
God, all right.
So
where was this?
No, it was at a place called Wunderboom, just near it's of Pretoria. It was a civilian airport.
Mm.
And I can remember Jane being extremely comforting. I mean, she was a nurse, and she just, you know, just wiped my brow, and I was soaking with sweat. And there was, as I said, there was blood all over the parachute. And these ambulance men came and straightened my leg and put on one of those blow-up sprints. And I could feel the bone grating against each other, you know. And this one here was, the pain was, it was excruciating.
Like a fractured femur.
Yeah, it was across that way and across that way. There's,
was that a compound fracture or not?
No, it was jutting out, it never broke the skin.
Yeah.
And, you know, the muscle held it in. And I got in there and I lay for about 4 hours. The accident happened about 3, I think it was. The ambulance picked me up at 3 and I lay there till 7 o'clock at night and they wouldn't give me morphine.
In the hospital?
In the hospital. And I just lay there and the pain. And Jane was with me the whole time. She got someone to take Billy home. And and I was really feeling sorry for myself, and I could hear this sort of sawing, grating noise in the background here, and there's a guy with a hang glider, you know, one of the part of a hang glider embedded inside him, and they were cutting the thing off, you know. Anyway, the doctor came out, and he was a very comforting man, Dr. Van Dyke. He sort of held my hands, he says, you know, he's straightforward, he says, you come out here with your legs on, it's a bonus, you know. Anyway,
is that what he said?
Aye. Well, I mean, the one thing about the Afrikaner, I don't mess about, right. You know.
And you had injured your back as well?
Yes.
I'd
done one of my vertebrae, and I done this part
neck,
here.
Your neck as well, yeah. I see.
Anyway, I went in there and I woke up, and I seen an open plaster.
Right.
And Jane had always told me beforehand, when leave a plaster open, you know, it's... They get worried about it, you know, and it wasn't a box that was cut. They normally cut what you call a window in it. It wasn't a window, it was a half plaster.
Right.
So I then spoke to the doctor, and I was severely depressed, you know.
Sure.
And I says, you're thinking of cutting my leg off, aren't you? He says, yes. I says,
the same Van Dyke as well?
Yeah. He says, yeah. I says, take her off. He says, no. He says, let me be the person who decides that. Then he came to see me, and he was all excited, and he had, you know, little bones in the leg, and he'd broken it all the same way mine was broken. He says, right, this is the situation. They laid all the bones out in front of me with all the breaks and whatnot. He says, this is the state of your legs.
How did he done this?
I don't know how he done it. He just came there, and it was all apart. He says, you got a break here and a break here. And he says, this is what I intend to do. And he said, I'm going to take a chunk off your hip and put a prop in there. Like, you know, see, the break was like that. He's going to prop it like you do with in a mine.
Mm.
And he says, you know, graft the bone in there. I says, Doc, is it going to work? He says, can you take 2 years, 2.5 years of pain? I says, yeah. And I took 2.5 years of pain.
Really?
And it was terrible.
How long were you in hospital?
I was in and out of hospital in a wheelchair for 2.5 years.
In a wheelchair for two and a half years? And was that in the form of traction, this leg, or?
No. At first there was no traction on me. They never put any on me. But everything was, you know, was in two plasters.
All right. You were in plaster for how long then?
Well, that was about 10, 12 weeks. Right. Just all the way down. And then they took this one off and put pins in it off my left leg. And then the problem was with the right one. And, you know, I mean, it was a mess. And
but were they talking about actually taking both legs off at one stage then?
Yeah.
In the beginning?
Yeah.
God Almighty, yeah.
Anyway, this one here, it was New Year's Day, and I had a plaster on this one, and this one was sort of, they'd put pins in it down each side, and I'd been drinking, and I could see a screw, and it was festering, and it was all sort of pus around the screw. And I said to my young brother, I says, right, William, and Jane was at work.
You know, who did you say this to?
Hey, my young brother, he'd come out to visit me.
Right.
I says, Terry, get the USOL, you know, Edinburgh University Solution of Life. He says, Peter, what are you up to? I says, bring me a Phillips screwdriver. So I took the screw out, you know, I just unscrewed it, and I thought it'd just be a little screw like this. In actual fact, it was about that length, about an inch and a half.
Yeah.
I screwed it out, and the thing got better, because you could never get the doctors over Christmas. It was a holiday. Anyway, I spoke to Dr. Van Dyke after Christmas. I said, Doctor, I think you've had a bit of patient failure. He says, what is it? I says, I took one of the screws out. And he said, Peter, you've done the right thing.
Oh, really?
Aye. So, as I say, it healed over. Anyway, you know, he was putting different plates in. And every time, he had 10 operations, and every time he operated, he always used to leave all the scrap at the side of the bed, you know, from my leg. And, you know, I sort of saved it up. And William used to bring his friends in. I had a big plate down here.
Right.
Just a straight plate.
Mm.
And I used to get these little, the kids in South Africa used to have these little magnetic marbles, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I'd put them on the side of my leg and they'd stick there. And they'd really be taken in by this. Anyway, typical, I said, I'm going to get fit again. So this leg felt fairly good, my left leg. And I went into a gym and I started doing curls. And I just, again, as you could just see, actually feel the plates coming out as I did
No.
I says, no, and my leg was actually sticking out, the skin, the plate of that, and He x-rayed the leg, and you could see the actual screws where they'd come apart.
Right.
He says, Peter, it's not working. So he drove two pins into the centre of my leg.
Right. And that was an internal plate.
Yeah. And he drove two pins up through the bone.
Yeah.
And it finally knitted like that. But I was probably the worst patient he had. But by the same token, he felt that I was fairly gutsy, and I was just pissed off all the time. And I was, you know, it was like I had been in a china shop.
Sure. Well, okay. So you were off work for how long?
I went back to work in a wheelchair. So
right.
I went back after about 4 months, 4.5 months, and I shouldn't have gone back.
Mm.
I should have looked after myself, and it was, you know, I felt that, you know, I had to show example, and in actual fact, the best example I could have showed was staying off work,
right.
Getting better and returning to work.
Right. Okay, we'll just check.